welcome to Life Before Vinyl on Resonance 104.4 FM. This is Adrian Tutnam, and I'm going to be your guide as we ramble through a miscellany of sounds from the forgotten past. Before the vinyl record became popular in the 1950s, there was already more than 50 years of sound recording history stored on discs. The vinyl record had come and gone, but the heavy brittle shellac discs that vinyl swept away seemed to have survived in surprisingly large quantities. Although many have been broken or badly damaged, the undamaged ones show no sign of natural deterioration. Today we're going to find out what they were made of, and some of the processes that went into their production. To start with, let's listen to a record that was not brittle at all. It was called a filmophone record and was so flexible that it could be rolled up and sent through the post. Unfortunately, it still shows a tendency to roll up while it's being played, and it's almost impossible to keep flat on the turntable. The one thing that stands out about it is the very low level of surface scratch. Here we have an unnamed whistler, who might be Guido Galdini, performing Il Baggio. Non-scratchy recording there on a filmophone record, which was made from some sort of celluloid compound. Well, if records could be made with a quiet surface like that, why on earth were the majority of records so scratchy? If you look at the edge of a broken shellac record, the material seems rough enough to be used as an abrasive. So what on earth were these records really made of, and why was it so rough and noisy? To answer these questions, I went to see Peter Copeland, retired technical manager of the British Library National Sound Archive. So I'm sitting here in Peter Copeland's living room. Peter is an expert on all sorts of things to do with recordings, and especially old records. And I'm going to ask a very simple question first, which will probably elicit a very complicated answer. Peter, we mentioned a few programmes ago that the only Bakelite records made were actually made by Edison. What were all the other records made of?
There are, of course, exceptions to every rule, and people tried making them out of paper and all sorts of things, but the vast majority of them were made out of so-called shellac, but in fact that is a composite of many kinds of material, which also varied from one manufacturer to another, and also varied as time went by. So it's almost impossible to give a straight answer to a straight question, I'm afraid. Shellac was in fact the principal binding agent used for holding the whole structure of the record together.
So how much of the record was shellac?
Never more than about one third, I would guess.
So what were the other two thirds?
Something like 50% slate dust, and the remainder would be colourings and various conditioners to keep the stuff stable through the manufacturing process. The idea was to resist the wear which would otherwise occur with a heavy needle playing the record. So an abrasive compound was always in the mix to make the needle fit the groove and to get it to fit the groove right before the music started. So it had to be a quick process.
So as soon as you put the needle on the record, it was being ground down to fit the groove.
That's right.
And these records, were they like this from the very beginning? Or was this something that was developed as they went along?
Both, in fact. From the very beginning, which was in the case of Berliner's very first little 5-inch records of the 1880s, they were, in fact, more like hard rubber. But after about 1894, Berliner introduced 7-inch records, and from those days on until the very last so-called 78 RPM discs, the variations in the composition were never more than about 10% either way anywhere.
So as early as 1894, Berliner was using shellac and slate dust compound.
That's right.
And did he invent this compound?
I think there was a lot of trial and error before he ended up with the right mixture. At that time, very early forms of plastics materials were coming onto the market. One example which comes to my mind very rapidly was the mouthpieces of telephones. So these plastics materials were around anyway, and I think Berliner just adapted the process to what he found empirically was needed.
And despite the fact that there's all this ground-up slate dust in it, records still look very, very shiny. Now, how did they manage that?
I think in this case it was the two components of the shellac, namely the slate dust and the binder, because the binder acts, as it were, to fill in the gaps between the particles of slate dust, and so that can be moulded to whatever smoothness the stamper is. And, of course, that also depended on developments in stampers, which is another can of worms.
Now, this seems like a good point to break off and have a listen to just how good the technology became. The record I'm about to play is a Regal, recorded in 1915. And considering that the surface you're hearing is actually made of a slate dust compound, the quality is really very good indeed.
Thank you.
Alexander Prince there, playing Jackanapes Polka in 1915, and recorded on a really quiet surface, which we now know was made of slate dust and shellac. You're listening to Life Before Vinyl on Resonance 104.4 FM. A few minutes ago, Peter Copeland was telling us that record material was pressed to give a good shiny surface by means of metal stampers. Let's find out a bit more about how these stampers were made from the master recordings. Right, well, now you've mentioned stampers, could you just take us through very briefly the very first process that Berliner used for making saleable copies of his original disc?
The idea was to record the original sound on, of all things, a zinc plate. This was covered with a very thin layer of some sort of animal fat. And the groove was actually embossed in that animal fat so that it exposed zinc underneath. Then Berliner could put the whole lot into an acid bath and the acid will eat away the zinc where the fat had been removed, thereby giving a groove. He then developed a method for making a negative of that, and that would then be used for stamping or moulding the pressed records, as we call them, with grooves.
So it was a three-part process. He started off with a wax-coated zinc plate. From that, he made some sort of a negative, and with that, he then stamped into the plastic material to get the actual records.
That's right, and history shows that it took in the best part of a decade to do that, because he started in 1888, and these things didn't come onto the market till 1894, and they were pretty rotten.
Right, so how long was it before he abandoned that process and moved on to the better one of actually cutting the groove in wax and going straight from there?
It is pretty certain that by about 1901, the Victor Company were cutting their masters in slabs of wax. Yes, because it continued, in fact it still continues to the present day with minor modifications.
So then how did they make the negatives from that?
The idea is that you take your original and we electroplate it. So you've got a very thin film, barely visible, of some conductive material on top of the wax. And then after that, you could put the whole shebang into an electroplating bath and grow as much heavy metal as you wanted on top of the wax. This then would give you a negative with ridges instead of grooves. You could then grow another positive on that negative and any number of negatives off any number of positives, and introduce a process of mass production and an empire-wide distribution of sound recordings.
So from that one wax disc, you finished up with many, many copies from which you pressed many more copies.
Yes.
And so the whole thing proliferated.
That's right. And moreover, you could export metal into parts so that factories in India or in Japan or wherever could press them and avoid the cost of distribution of all the records from one factory.
When Berliner's assistant, Fred Gaisberg, first came over from the United States to start making recordings, there was no pressing plant in this country. The master waxes were sent off to Germany, where Berliner's brother had established a plastics factory for making telephone parts. The records were pressed in Hanover and then shipped back here for resale, which shows that globalisation of industry really isn't anything new. We can tell that the next record was one that was pressed abroad, because it has a continental run-out groove added between the end of the recording and the label. Some gramophones were fitted with automatic stop devices, which operated from a sudden inward movement of the playing arm. Spiral run-out grooves for this purpose were usually quite gentle, but the ones added by German factories before the First World War were very coarse and quite violent in their action. Many a German record has finished the tune in style by slinging the sound box right across the label and into the grooves on the opposite side. Here is a selection from the Prince of Pilsen, played by His Majesty's Coldstream Guards, recorded in London, and pressed in a telephone factory in Hanover in 1904. Selection from The Prince of Pilsen by Gustav Lüders, recorded in 1904. You're listening to Life Before Vinyl on Resonance 104.4 FM. As well as the spiral run-out groove, all sorts of other marks and numbers were added to the record before it was pressed. I knew that Peter Copeland was a world expert on these marks, so I asked him to explain why were they there.
The main problem I think that faced recording engineers in the very earliest days of gramophone records was that there was no way you could label the recording. And therefore, the only way that it could possibly be done so that muddles wouldn't occur downstream was to scratch an identification right on the outside edge of the recording. But the trouble with that is, of course, that you don't normally see the outside edges, especially after they've been trimmed off at the end of the manufacturing process. So it became necessary to rewrite the information in a more neat and a more compact form somewhere near the middle of the disc where it might be preserved. And this gives rise to the phrase, which is still used to this day, of a matrix number. This identifies the metalwork which from which all the subsequent copies are made and is usually arranged to appear somewhere in the middle of the disc between the end of the recording and the outside edge of the label. There may be a great deal more information appearing as the manufacturing process got more and more complicated. To start with, there might be a problem that a particular recording company might have two studios, one on the east coast of America and one on the west coast of America, and they could end up with two matrices with the same number if you weren't jolly careful. There might be further complications because the various generations through which the sound recording went, the positive, the negative, the positive, and any number of subsequent negatives, might also get all muddled up. And there would be numbering and lettering systems which would identify the pieces of metal. Before you know where you are, you've got a complicated system of codes appearing on the final records, which, if you put on your thinking cap and get a number of different examples, you can usually decode to try and decide what all the various characters and numbers and letters actually mean. And this, I'm afraid, has been one of the things that I've wasted a lot of my own time doing in order to try and decide how many records were made by which company, at which plant, at which date, and what the actual numbers and letters actually mean.
Well, I think I've got enough to be getting my brain around for this week, and Peter Copeland will be continuing with his explanation of how to read the marks on records next week. If you want to follow him decoding an actual record, have the Life Before Vinyl webpage ready on your computer screen next week as you listen to the programme. You'll be able to find the home page from the Resonance FM programme listings. Then click on the record icon in the Programme 11 panel to get the details. So, this is Adrian Tuddenham thanking you for listening and looking forward to your company again next week, when we shall be hearing some more about matrix numbers and stamper codes. In the meantime, here is Tommy Handley with a lovely bit of nonsense to cheer us all up. It's called The Polar Bears Come Back.
Here's a little story all about an Eskimo by the name of Joe. A hunting he did go. He went out to shoot a bear, that's how the story goes. And now this question's being asked by all the Eskimos. Has anybody here seen Joe, the funny little Eskimo? The last time someone saw him, he was running across the snow. A very big polar bear was rumbling on his track. Joe the Eskimo ain't here, but the polar bear's come back. Very, very sad this is. Now Joe went out to shoot the bear at 4 a.m. they say. Before he went away, he told his wife that day, I'll bring home a nice bear skin to keep you snug and warm. The bear's still got his skin and wife has got a frozen form. Has anybody here seen Joe, the funny little Eskimo? The last time someone saw him, he was running across the snow. A very big polar bear was rumbling on his track. Joe the Eskimo ain't here, but the polar bear's come back. Oh, things are getting desperate, you know. Iceland, Scotland Yard is looking for this Eskimo. But up to now we know they haven't found poor Joe. Sergeant Snowball and his hound are hot upon his trail. We understand he's got some salt to put on Bruin's tail. Has anybody here seen Joe, the funny little Eskimo? The last time someone saw him, he was running across the snow. A very big polar bear was rumbling on his track. Joe the Eskimo ain't here, but the polar bear's come back. He's missing, still missing. I fear he ran too slow. And now, dear friends, the story ends without poor Joe.